If you ever wondered how our views of the past changed, just take a look at how the story of the Indian Wars have been told. For many years, the cavalry were the good guys and the Indians were the enemy. More recently, the moral equation has been reversed. In Nathaniel Philbrick's latest book, The Last Stand, Custer, Sitting Bull, and the Battle of Little Bighorn, General George Custer, the famous American cavalry officer, and Sitting Bull, the equally famous Lakota chief, are both complex characters, neither hero nor villain. Mr. Philbrick is the author of the international bestsellers In the Heart of the Sea, which won the National Book Award, and Mayflower, which was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. The Last Stand is published by Viking, and I'm very pleased that it brings Nathaniel Philbrick back to our show today. Hi.
Hi, it's great to be back.
Now, you live on Nantucket Island in Massachusetts, which I think was one of the reasons you've written all those books about the sea and the sailors who've sailed them. What brought you to landlocked American West?
Well, when I was 14 years old, a freshman in high school in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, I saw the movie Little Big Man, and it just blew the top of my head off. This is Custer as the deranged maniac, and I became fascinated with that whole myth, and I wanted to come back to it.
There have been a lot of films made about the battle. And the one I remember first is They Died with Their Boots On,
yes,
which was made in 1941, 30 years before Little Big Man. And in that one, Errol Flynn is a heroic figure and a friend of the Indians.
Yes, but America was on its way to steeling itself for the World War II. You know, we were in a mood to look for leadership, patriotism, cooperation, and Errol Flynn personified that.
And when did everything change? When did we wind up with Richard Mulligan playing Custer as manic and somewhat psychotic, and then later we get Dances with Wolves, and we get all these movies in which the Indians are heroic figures.
Well,
most recently, Avatar.
Absolutely. World War II was the good war. Then we make our way gradually into the swamp of the Vietnam War era, and our attitudes towards the military, towards America's role in the geopolitical scene changed completely. And Custer, who's been an icon ever since he died on Little Bighorn, began to reflect those changing times. And so, you know, Custer of Little Big Man is very much in the Vietnam War era.
And you seem to have come up with a compromise.
Yeah, well, you know, it's when I worked on Mayflower, that was about the Pilgrims, just as iconic. And I found it how fascinating and how complex the historical reality was. And that was one of the reasons why I wanted to come to this story.
You quote a famous line from William Faulkner's Absalom, Absalom, "Maybe nothing ever happens once and is finished."
Yes, nothing ended at the Battle of Little Bighorn. I have become completely convinced after 4 years with this topic. I mean, you know, we fought this battle in the middle of our country. We thought we had won the West just when Custer was so completely defeated. And as a consequence, every generation will come back to this story.
Well, up until Korea, we pretty much won every war, didn't we?
Yes. Yes, we won every war, and so we came back to, you know, Custer was an instant myth. It was the myth of the last stand, going down in a blaze of glory. And I think now, with the Vietnam War era, now 9/11, with terrorism, things are shifting, and it's hard to see that in heroic terms.
And we perhaps accept the complications of war in Iraq and Afghanistan a little more than the American public did when Custer was defeated?
Right. And I think, you know, my view of this is trying to take into account that, you know, now at this time, you know, we recognize that even if it's a bad war, a soldier is fulfilling his orders. And Custer was in that very similar situation.
And thinking about those movies, to some degree, you also have to separate fact from myth.
Mm-hmm.
Although I'm not sure how much they feed each other even today.
Yeah, well, you know, one thing I've seen is if the historical facts come even close to a myth, like The Last Stand, the myth takes over. And so evidence is a huge part of the story. Everyone knew this was history even before it was over. Everyone was calculating what to say. Even when it came to the Lakota and Cheyenne survivors, everyone died under Custer. So there's that mystery that will always hover over that. And so I think this makes it a tantalizing thing. No one will ever know completely what happened.
But would it have been different if the soldier had not been George Custer? Because he's a special case, isn't he?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Custer was a special case, very controversial figure, great dash, long flowing locks, even though he didn't have flowing locks in this battle. And he definitely contributed to it. But, you know, if he hadn't lost so magnificently, we wouldn't be talking about it.
Well, how did someone who graduated last in his class at West Point go on to achieve so much success as the boy general during the Civil War and afterwards until this final defeat?
Yeah, I mean, we think of him as history's biggest loser, but the fact of the matter is, in the Civil War, he was one of our great cavalry officers, and his career out west, beginning in Kansas, was more controversial. But he still had definite skills, and but you know, he was also a man following orders in a botched campaign in terms of how it was conceived from the very beginning in 1876, and that all led to the Battle of Little Bighorn.
How was Sitting Bull as a military leader?
Well, Sitting Bull was one of those incredible figures. I mean, he was extraordinarily charismatic, politically savvy, and then also a real visionary. And that all combined to give him, be the person that his people needed at this extraordinary time.
What about his upbringing? Did that affect the way he approached the Americans, like, and the American military?
Like a typical Lakota male of his era, he had grown up as a warrior, and he had been one of the foremost warriors of his people. And by the time of the Little Bighorn, he was in his 40s, aged out of that, and had really become in many ways a political and spiritual leader.
Well, we tend to think of this land as the Native Americans' land and the Europeans as the invaders. But if I remember my history correctly, the Sioux came into the Great Plains somewhere around the end of the 15th century, around the same time Columbus was making his first voyage.
Yeah, well, you know, we think of the Old West as sort of this tableau, but it was a everything was changing, and the Lakota had been pushed west and had taken over the land of the Crow. The Crow aligned with the American government to try to stop the Lakota. And I quote from someone in my book that said, you know, to an army officer, you're doing just what we did to all the Indians around here, you know, taking our land. And so, you know, it's coming from both sides in this.
Didn't public opinion of Sitting Bull change over the course of his lifetime?
Well, as soon after the battle, he soon after that went in exile in Canada, and during that period granted several newspaper interviews that took a big role in making him one of the more famous personages in the United States. And when he finally surrendered to American authorities and was stationed at the Pine Ridge Agency in North Dakota, he would go on two national tours, one with Buffalo Bill Wild West Show, and this gave him, it was almost a reconnaissance mission for him. It gave him the opportunity to see what this invader is all about.
But it also would represent a recognition that he was a brilliant military strategist. Otherwise, he might not have been treated as one of the stars of the Buffalo Bill show.
Yeah, and he was, I mean, here's a case, the myth even precedes the man in this instance. You know, people had heard about Sitting Bull but didn't really know much about him. And so you see this joining.
Well, I was shocked to learn that he was killed by Native American security officers on the reservations where he was living. How did that come to pass?
Well, it's 1890, 14 years after the Little Bighorn, and conditions are just terrible on the reservations. And a new religious movement springs up among the native peoples of the plains called the Ghost Dance. And the superintendent of the reservation, who had never liked Sitting Bull and done everything he could to undercut his power within the tribe, decided that Sitting Bull might lead an insurrection, and so sent the native police to arrest him. Shots were fired in the early morning hours of December, and Sitting Bull and several of his family members were killed. And so 14 years after Custer, he suffered his own last stand.
And how was that dealt with within the Native American community? Because must have been a kind of a hero to many young people.
It's created a legacy that is tortured somewhat. And you know, and what adding to this is that some of Sitting Bull's leaders fled south, ended up at Wounded Knee, where the 7th Cavalry, Custer's old regiment, unleashed the furor that became the massacre at Wounded Knee.
My guest is Nathaniel Philbrick. His latest book, The Last Stand, Custer, Sitting Bull, and the Battle of the Little Bighorn, which is published by Viking. You spoke to Sitting Bull's great-great-grandson?
Yes, Ernie LaPointe, and who lives in the Black Hills. And he, you know, related the oral traditions he had heard from his mother, who had gotten them from Sitting Bull's daughter, and specifically about what happened, for example, in that cat in his cabin at the end, and many other. And he's published his own book about those traditions.
Well, how much can you trust his view? Because I'm sure he's caught up in the family legend as well.
Yeah, and I mean, this is the thing about oral tradition. It changes over time to reflect the times that the people are in. And so, but there are other traditions that were recorded much closer to Sitting Bull's time in the 1930s, still very much later. And so, I mean, that's one of the essences of the story, the issue of evidence.
I would wonder how a descendant of George Custer might tell the story.
Yes. I mean, family members are, you know, always have their point of view.
Throughout, you suggest that there were parallels between the lives of George Custer and Sitting Bull. What character traits do they share?
Well, you know, they were both great warriors. Both had a sense of their own destiny when it came to their people. Custer wanted to be a great man. He wanted to be remembered. That certainly happened. Sitting Bull saw himself as the one who had the welfare of his people firmly in view, even when he was a young, you know, even before he was born, something was going on there.
Although in the case of Custer, he also has manifest destiny behind him.
He
has an American sense the way things are going to develop. He has to win, doesn't he, just because that's the way history is moving?
That's right. I mean, and all throughout his career, even when things were going bad, he could count on what he called Custer luck to bring it around. And he was part of a national march west, and the West was about to be won, and his was to be the crowning glory.
Did they experience any similar life-defining events before they wound up meeting in this battle?
Well, you know, visionary events are a really big part of the story. And just as the 7th Cavalry was leaving Fort Lincoln on its way to begin this campaign, there was a vision. The cavalry was coming out of a fog, and Libby, his wife, would later recount how there was a reflection of half the cavalry up in the sky. And half the regiment would fall during this battle. And then Sitting Bull, just a week before the battle, on a Sundance, would have a vision of soldiers upside down falling into camp. And so the mystical visionary aspect of experience is a part of the story on both sides.
What about strategies? Often battles are defined by the strategies of the generals.
Yeah, well, Sitting Bull from the beginning wanted to keep his people together. The feeling was that if they could get a large number together, that no one would dare attack. And they had 8,000 Lakota and Cheyenne in this village, one of the largest gatherings ever.
And the Lakota and the Cheyenne were cooperating?
Yes. As of the last few years before that, Sitting Bull had forged an alliance, which was, you know, part of what he brought to his people. And then Custer, on the other hand, had a whole different set of concerns. His big fear, as every military officer's concern, was not the size of the village, but that it would disperse before they could attack it. The Lakota and Cheyenne were so mobile that if given any warning, they could go off in a million directions and you'd lose your opportunity. And that's why Custer divided his command just before the final attack.
But wasn't he concerned that he was so outnumbered?
He had no clue. Because of the terrain, you could not see the village until you were right upon it. And so everyone says, "Oh, Custer, no reconnaissance." But there was no way given that he had already been seen, that he could have had someone look and then have the time to decide what to do.
Now, it isn't just Sitting Bull. There are other Native American figures, Crazy Horse, who was Oglala Sioux?
Yes, and Crazy Horse was really the foremost warrior. And once the battle began, it would be Crazy Horse who would emerge as the battle leader and organize the first attack and take it from there.
And the leading Cheyenne figure is Wooden Leg.
Well, he was a young warrior at that time, but he would leave a very detailed account that is extremely helpful in finding, determining what happened. But there were others, Lame White Man, Yellow Nose. This was a chaotic battle. You couldn't see much, smoke, dust, and so you know, countless warriors played a part.
Well, when it comes to that kind of battle where just these two groups meet, is there any strategy, or is it just simply the force that...
There was very little strategy involved when it came to Custer's portion of the battle. It was, from many accounts, it began slowly as the warriors infiltrated the grasslands around him. And then some say it was over in 20 minutes. There was not much they could do. They were so outnumbered, and they were outgunned, which comes to a surprise for most people. Well,
because we would have assumed that the cavalry would have had better equipment.
Right. They did not have the state-of-the-art weapon at the time. To save money, the military had given the soldiers single-shot carbines. Many of the Lakota and Cheyenne warriors had Henry and repeaters, Winchester repeaters, that could fire as many as 17 rounds at a time and in close fighting. This was a huge advantage.
Where had they gotten those rifles?
From trading posts, and you know, they recognized these as immensely superior, and so they did everything to acquire them.
We call it Custer's last stand, but you say this is really the story of two last stands.
Yeah, I mean, it's looked to as a great victory for Sitting Bull and his people. But the fact of the matter is, within a year and a half, just about all the major leaders and their people, whether Lakota or Cheyenne, were on the reservations. And when that and the buffalo were on their way to almost extinction, and without a food source, there was no way they could pursue their traditional lifestyle. And so, in many ways, this was also the Lakota last stand. I don't think you can begin to appreciate what we have mythologized as Custer's last stand unless you put it in the context of what happened to Sitting Bull and his people.
So the Indians were fighting to maintain their freedom. They wind up in reservations anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, and Sitting Bull recognized that this battle, even if it was a great victory for them, could not necessarily change the tide, and so he had tried to negotiate when this began.
Is it significant that the Battle of Little Bighorn took place just weeks before the American Centennial?
Absolutely. Custer's timing was exquisite. This battle was fought June 25, 1826. Word of the battle did not get to the East Coast till July 7th, 3 days after this nationwide celebration. Just when, with the Civil War behind the nation, with the West about to be won, they hear that America's foremost Indian fighter has been wiped out to a man. And everyone said, how could this happen? Revenge, revenge. And we've been trying to figure out what happened ever since.
But revenge wasn't really wreaked, was it? Although, I guess Native Americans might say there was a huge revenge because they pretty much all wound up in reservations.
Yeah, but funding for the military was immediately increased. They redoubled their efforts against the Lakota and Cheyenne. Within months, efforts were made to build forts on what had been native land. And so this battle really had a bad consequence in the long term.
I'm assuming that you went to all of the areas that are discussed in this book.
Yes. Every year, I've been working on this book for 4 years and have been out there five times now, and for sometimes a week, sometimes for weeks. And it's whether it's North Dakota, the Black Hills, I've spent a lot of time at the battlefield.
Do people talk about these battles in the same way that they talk about the Civil War battles when you go to the old battlegrounds?
Yeah, I mean, it's like it, but it's different. When you go to the Little Bighorn battlefield, it takes your breath away to see the scene. It is over a wide, flat valley where the village was located. Custer was killed on what's now known as Last Stand Hill, speckled with the grave markers where the soldiers fell. It's an incredibly spiritual and haunting landscape. I've been there five times now, and every time I go there, it's as if I've never been there before. It's just a very emotionally involving escape.
You talked to some descendants, but you also read memoirs and diaries.
Mm-hmm.
What did they reveal? Did the soldiers like Custer? Did they consider him a great leader?
Custer was a lightning rod. You either loved him or you hated him. And so some of the officers say how, you know, he was just terrific right to the end, and others, particularly Major Marcus Reno and Frederick Benteen, who were, you know, just below Custer, they despised him. And so their accounts, whether it's in letters, memoirs, or in some instances testimony, there was a court of inquiry, do not reflect kindly on Custer.
And why did they despise him? What did he do?
Well, he was a flamboyant character who played to the press, who was out to promote himself shamelessly. And
you think he had higher aspirations?
According to the Arikara scouts, he told them that with a great victory, he would become the great father. There was an election looming. Whether or not he actually said that, I found a letter from his father during the Civil War, which basically predicts, George, if you keep it up, you're going for the White House. So there were political ambitions were part of the family lore.
And this sort of thing had happened earlier. War heroes have become presidents.
Oh, absolutely.
Andrew Jackson. Well, George Washington, Andrew Jackson, Dwight D. Eisenhower.
Right. Now, Custer had not had good experiences politically. He had testified before a committee looking into corruption in the Grant administration. This had infuriated Grant, who had stripped Custer of command of the column. And so, he had been under a political cloud, but, this also may inspire you to try to get it all back with one big victory.
So here you are now writing about the American West. Are you going to go back to the sea, or this led you into other interesting areas?
Well, I'm fascinated by communities, whether a nomadic Indian village or cavalry or ship at sea under stress. And I'm now, and I've also, like many Americans, the American Revolution has been something that's interested me. And so my next project is to focus on the city of Boston in the early years of the Revolution, with the arrival of the troops and what happened there. Because, it wasn't just an ideological push to freedom. It was in many ways a civil war as well. So that's where I'm headed next.
Well, the fun thing about writing about history is it's always more complicated than the story we learned in high school.
Yes, and it's for me, it's become my life's work.
Nathaniel Philbrick, who is the author of Mayflower and In the Heart of the Sea, now The Last Stand, Custer, Sitting Bull, and the Battle of the Little Bighorn, published by Viking. He will be reading and signing books tonight at 7:30 at the Lincoln Square Barnes & Noble store. That's at Broadway at 65th Street, is it? 66th Street?
Sounds good.
And I want to thank you so much for being
with
us again.
Oh, it's great to be back.